This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
It's general election part two today on Political Soapbox.
Order! Order!
Hello, welcome to the Political Soapbox, here where politics is not just for elections, it's for life. every week. And we're joined by what may be at some point today all of the election candidates for the general election today, as we're expecting Bob Seeley to be turning up late again this week. But I'd just like you to start by introducing everybody once again to the show.
I'm Julie Jones-Evans and I'm the independent candidate for the Isle of Wight.
I'm Nick Belfitt, I'm the Liberal Democrat candidate for the Isle of Wight.
I'm Daryl Pitcher, I'm the UKIP candidate for the Isle of Wight.
I'm Vic Stathian, I'm the Green Party candidate for the Isle of Wight.
And I'm Julian Critchley, and I'm the Labour candidate also for the Isle of Wight.
I'm glad we cleared up.
We've missed constituency.
Just in case anyone's listening in Hull or somewhere. So today we're just going to talk about some key issues. We'll go through and listen to each of your opinions, and then we're going to just have a kind of chat. Nothing too formal here, as we kind of go through and just find out what different opinions are on some kind of big issues. Now, obviously, this week, one thing that has completely dominated this election has been the terrorist attack in Manchester. So I'd like to start by just hearing about how you propose to deal with kind of extremism and terrorism, how you propose to kind of move forward from this, and what we can do to help prevent acts like this happening again in our country. So if we can start with Julie.
Oh, thank you. I've been sort of following things very closely this week, obviously, this, you know, horrific incident. And one thing that sort of jumped out at me is the cuts to our community policing. We had Damien Riley, who spoke 2 years ago at the Police Federation conference, where Theresa May was present as well, who warned that this lack of the frontline, the community policing, meant that they couldn't be proactive. They weren't getting information from the community. They were having just to be reactive all the time. So there's that big disconnect between what was happening in the communities and what the police could actually do. And he said, you know, we're going to end up with a paramilitary style policing. Mm. And he also said that this could lead to a national security incident. Theresa May called him out and said, no, you're scaremongering, this isn't going to happen. Yet 2 years later, what have we got? We've got armed police in the streets of Newport. We have a serious incident happening. So, you know, we have to rebuild our communities. And I see the police locally having to deal with mental health issues as well. You know, they had to lock up on mental health, someone suffered poor mental health the other day. Now, how is that helping the police or that person? It's just things are crumbling at the front, and we have to reconnect with our communities. If we rebuild our communities, we can rebuild the country.
Nick, so, you know, we've seen this week, as Judy said, that police, armed police officers around ferry terminals and in Newport. What are your thoughts on how we move forward?
Well, I think Julie's very correct on the fact that we need more police, and this one, I'm really proud that the Liberal Democrats are going to put £300 million towards police services to get police just back into the streets, back into communities and working with communities, and £7 million of that will come to the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary, and we should see hopefully more better developments and being able to tackle these problems, as well as making sure that we have police on the streets and not having to revert to army officers, which I think actually is quite terrifying for a lot of people to know that there are soldiers on the streets, when actually if we funded the police forces properly we would only have police on the streets. One thing I would also say though is what this shows is that the current usage of things like the Snoopers Charter and all the surveillance programs that which they take information from us, they're not working. They're not working because these people who are turning to extremism tend to be people who are feeling left out of society, that they're homegrown people who have turned to extremism and then attack our society, which is the failure of our society to keep our own people wanting to stay part of that society rather than trying to endanger it. So I think what we need to look at is a program of how we're going to help people who are getting turned to radicalism, our own people, how we stop them from turning to radicalism and bring them back into society. And I think that's got to come through our education systems, because maybe if we properly fund things like education systems, these young people who are being turned to radicalisation will actually stay as part of the community and help build the community rather than trying to destroy it.
Daryl, how do we prevent something like this happening again?
I have to take Nick up on a couple of points he just made. For a start off, although I don't like surveillance particularly. I'm a libertarian. I don't like surveillance. But it must be stated that the intelligence services have come out and said that that since the Westminster attack, they've forwarded another 5 plots since then. So clearly something's working. Things will always get through. There are something like 3,500 people on the watch list at the moment. And I saw another statistic today, which is even more alarming, saying there's something like 23,000. Mm. It was on the front page of the paper. I've been out all morning. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But I believe it was 23,000 that they were saying potentially radicalised Muslims. And let's actually say it for what it is, because people have been, you know, beating around the bush. We're talking about one particular religion in this case. It is causing the problem. We're not talking about radical Christians, we're talking about radical Muslims, and they are the ones that are causing the problem and committing these acts. And these are heinous acts, so they've got to stop. It's not all Muslims, we know that, but unfortunately it's a radical minority, but they also have an awful lot of support from within their own community. If you ask a room of Muslims and say, will you commit this act? Most of them will say no. Would you support the act? And you get a much bigger number that say, yes, actually, we don't mind it happening. And that's very worrying, because we have a group of people within our society, and they never will be part of our society, because they don't want to be part of our society, because their religion tells them not to be part of our society.
No, it does. That's the problem.
Okay.
You can't say it's
I don't think that it's religion. I think it's a cultural aspect of the radical aspect of that religion. And I'm sure that Julian's going to talk about this as well, but it's looking at how our foreign policy relates to that. You know, we got the young man who blew himself up and murdered all those people, you know, from a Libyan background. And what did we do in Libya? You know, we went in there, we left it an unstable state, we've left it a failed state, and we don't even have hardly any jurisdiction to go after the family of that man in there. We're having to use militia in order to do that, because there is no organisation. And that's because the United States and Britain and their allies went in there and completely unstabilised that nation. And we have to recognise that. That is not an excuse, that is an explanation. And we need to look for explanations. And like the others have said, completely back what Julie said about the police force, but and the intelligence services, as Daryl said, we need to properly fund our intelligence services. We need to defend our country, right? And that defence does not necessarily come through nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons is not going to solve us from having those suicide bombers. We need to actually put defence back into our police and back into conventional and back into intelligence. And that's how we're going to stop that from happening again. And that's the most important thing to do, is to stop this from happening again. We do not want any more of our children and parents and fathers that were murdered, and people who've been badly injured from that. We've got to stop it happening, and we can only do that through using better intelligence.
Okay, Julian, what were your thoughts on this?
Okay, the reason I was picking Daryl up is he said their religion tells them to do this. The Muslim religion... No, it doesn't. The Muslim religion quite clearly does not tell Muslims to go out and blow themselves up and murder children. It does not. Those particular... And let's be honest, they are psychopaths. But those particular psychopaths might interpret a particular brand of their religion. But in the same way that, you know, I've just been out on the streets of Newport and there's been 3 different types of Christianity preaching at me and offering leaflets. It's just wrong to say their religion teaches them to do that. It doesn't. And that's the sort of thing that leads us down a very nasty, dark slope into some unpleasantness. Coming back to the issue about what do we do about this, the answer is, and, you know, absolutely blunt, I don't know. I don't know what we do about this, because this is different. This is different from previous terrorism in the West. I mean, previous terrorism in the West tended to be political groups, national groups that were fighting for a specific cause that you could recognise and for which there was some form of political solution. You know, I mean, Northern Ireland would be a classic example where, you know, we knew what the terrorists wanted, and the way we actually ended up resolving that was actually by giving some ground. They gave some ground, and we met somewhere that wasn't quite in the middle, but ended with the Good Friday Agreement. Likewise, if you look at terrorist groups elsewhere, you have the same where you can negotiate with them, where there is a structure, where there is a clear goal, that's fine. What we have here is we have overwhelmingly young, radicalised men who have been radicalised on the internet, often on their own, and then being put in touch with a network of other radicalised men. And the question of how do you negotiate with people who don't have that sort of political goal, and that is difficult.
But
we do know what they want, though.
I don't think we do.
They want to overthrow a democratic system and introduce an Islamic
state. Are you sure that's what that guy killed himself?
I mean, that's what Islamic state...
Because some of them have been saying that they're doing this as a direct response to British foreign policy overseas. But they actually say that. So, for example, the 7/7 bombers, you know, were a direct response to British foreign policy.
Well, if that's the case, then we can solve that situation, can't we?
Well, some of them don't. I actually agree with you in terms of goals. It is hard because this terrorist network is so open that they have a number of different goals, and a lot of them is just really just to cause chaos. But the only thing I would say is the solution to it isn't that these people, because it isn't, like you said, like an established group that have goals and are planning it. It's people who have been left out of the system, who have been pushed to the side maybe because they have their certain cultural views, and because they've been pushed to the side for so long, they turn to radicalism as an outlet for their own problems, and that's the failure of society. No one else is to blame. You can't blame a faith. You can blame them for perhaps the aspects of radicalizing, but the fact these people have got to this point where they feel like they need to hurt people, that's the failure of our society. And what we need to do is find a way to make sure that more young men are not falling down this trap. Because if we stop the supply of people going to these countries becoming radicalized, then that's how we'll defeat them.
Some people would say that after 9/11, you know, we heard George Bush and the other politicians agree that there is now a war on terror, and our impact in the Middle East has meant that we've been at war with other countries, and this is just, you know, the terrorist attacks that happen on our country is just part of that war, that there are impact on and what's happening in the rest of the world. This is what we're fighting, and sometimes that attack comes on us, sometimes it happens elsewhere, in the same way that we have been bombing different countries, different parts of different countries elsewhere. Do you, like I know Julian has said about that link between the what we've been doing in the Middle East, and especially around after the Arab Spring and all sorts of things different happening in that area, actually we have a responsibility for that, and because of that we're finding the effects now here.
I mean, I could just say because obviously today the Labour Party leader is in the news all over the place for his statement on foreign policy and again being rather badly misrepresented, but in a sense, I think most of those newspapers and the politicians' statements over the last 24 hours have completely missed the point. They're saying, well, you know, we don't see that there is a link between our foreign policy and what these bombs are. It doesn't matter if we don't see there's a link. What matters is whether the people who are doing the bombing think there's a link. And they do. They do absolutely think there's a link. So, you know, that doesn't mean... Of course that doesn't mean that we just cave in to everything that they want. Of course it doesn't mean that. What it means is that any approach to this has to be multipolar. It has to be exactly what Nick says, which is about reducing the deprivation and exclusion of people in society. It means exactly what Vic says, which is we need to concentrate on intelligence so that we can actually get some more detection in advance. But you know, it doesn't start with sort of stupid posturing of you know, we mustn't say that this is in any way connected to the wider world, because of course it is.
I think that we've seen evidence of other events happening in those soils in the Middle East, of you know, the coach of children, you know, 68 children that had been, you know, killed. We are just seeing a reflection of that with us, and as terrible as the 22 people killed and their families and the people being maimed and people being injured, this is happening daily elsewhere. So it is a reminder that we are involved in a much bigger global aspect, and it needs a global solution.
There is definitely some truth in the idea that, you know, we have done an awful lot of things in the Middle East and in North Africa that we probably shouldn't have done. We shouldn't have got involved in those countries, and we have done. In actual fact, we've actively, you know, behind the scenes, particularly the Americans, it must be said, behind the scenes of, you know, actively try to foment revolutions in places. And that's a bad idea, because it does come back to bite you eventually. And they've used, you know, they're you may not like President Assad, and you know he's not a very nice man, and he's killed a lot of his own people. But he is secular, and he was no threat to Great Britain. However, the Americans decided that, you know, using radical Islam would be a good wheeze to try and get rid of him. Well, we've just seen what happens when you do that. It's not a good idea. So, you know, there is a degree of responsibility for those sort of actions. Unstabilising the whole region is not a very good plan.
Okay, just very quickly on this, Bob. We've been talking about the... so Bob Seeley from the Conservative Party has just joined us in the studio. We're talking about the terror attack at the moment and how I know the Conservatives are led on the Prevent programme and things, but what should we... what should our country be doing to prevent further attacks like this?
I'm coming to this, I was just picking up on the comments of other people. Can I just correct Daryl? There is absolutely no evidence that the Americans have tried to use radical Islam against Assad. It's simply an untrue. I think they've had to make some incredibly difficult policy choices, as have the Brits. And sort of working a little bit, as I have done in the Middle East in the past, these choices are not easy ones to make. And so just to make sweeping statements, I think, is incredibly unhelpful. And just on President Assad, you're right, he isn't necessarily a threat, but he's killed 250,000 of his own people in the most horrific and extreme circumstances. And I'm not making a party political point out of this, but under Tony Blair, you know, the UN invented or came up with or evolved, however you want to phrase it, this right to protect. Now, there is an issue. We have seen or have come to believe that there is a moral responsibility for us as Western states or the world community, however you want to phrase it, to act when we see grotesque incidents of human rights abuses. And after Rwanda, everyone said never again, because a million people, how many was it, were slaughtered. So, you know, if we weren't acting, and actually we're not doing that much in Syria, actually what we're doing, the Brits are spending a great deal of money on aid, so we shouldn't even be a target according to the logic of if we're spending money on aid, we shouldn't be being attacked. And it might be that if this guy who's done the killings this weekend, this appalling man, if he actually was in Syria and in Libya, it does somewhat undermine the argument that we're being attacked because of our responsibility, because all the world's problems are ours. I don't buy that idea that we are guilty for the world's problems, that some people on the left, I'm not saying anyone here, but that some people on the left have peddled. And I think that's false, and I think there are national leaders are doing that, and I would strongly disagree with them.
OK, I want to move on to talk now about defence and about how much we've seen Trump this week talking on NATO and the UK being one of the top three countries that spend the most amount of money towards NATO. Is this something how much money should we be spending on defence and supporting other countries? Is NATO something we should be part of? And what are your thoughts about how we kind of work together to fight and to defend our country? So if we start with Nick on this one.
I think we've got to take a very big position of responsibility. I don't actually agree with Bob. I actually think the past stuff that we've done when we've illegally gone into wars without UN backing has actually been quite a disgrace for us as a country. The fact that we always used to fight for what with the backing of the international group, being part of the League of Nations before that, and actually what we need to do now in our position as part of NATO is to make sure that we are responding to threats, especially to European countries, and we're backing that up. But what I'd like to see from the UK is less of an aggressive military style that we saw under Tony Blair's government, and maybe something that's a bit more defensive with incorporating our European allies. I don't take Trump's stance of this kind of gun-ho approach, shoot people, ask questions later kind of approach. I think we need to be more responsible with our European allies and maintain our secure defence. I disagree with Vix from the Green Party. I think Trident is part of that defence. It does need to be scaled correctly so it can work efficiently. However, when I see Donald Trump in the West and when I see Vladimir Putin in the East and what he's done to Ukraine, a country who gave up its nuclear weapons and then was simply invaded not too long after, I feel that we do need a strong defence. I don't want to be an aggressor. I want to protect what we've got, what our communities are, and I want to work with our European allies to make sure that we protect those things.
Daryl.
Yeah, just on the Ukraine point, one of the things that some people miss, when Ukraine actually gave up their nuclear weapons, Britain was one of the countries that actually signed to guarantee their security. And we haven't exactly stepped up to that mark, I would say. I agree with Nick. I think nuclear weapons are important. Trident is important. I would certainly keep it. I think there are enough threats in the world that it's still a valid thing to have. When you look at some of the other world leaders, you know, you've got Trump on one side and Putin on the other, and the Chinese and North Korea. Any of those at any time could become an issue for us. And we need to be able to defend ourselves. And the best defence is not to need to defend yourselves. And if you've got the weapons there, then generally, you know, it's the old mutually assured destruction. You don't actually need to use them because they don't want to be destroyed themselves. So that's why it's a deterrent. In the UKIP manifesto, there is a pledge to increase spending on the armed forces. They do an awful lot of good work. They do a lot of aid work and humanitarian work, and that's very important. And we do live in uncertain times, and they need the equipment and they need the manpower to be able to do the job to defend us. So we are very firm supporters of the armed services, and also the veterans when they come out of the armed services, because we really need to make sure that our veterans are properly looked after.
Okay, Vix.
Well, nuclear weapons ties us into NATO, and NATO ties us into this bipolar view of the planet that we thought we had moved on from 1990, and we clearly haven't. So we can see with Donald Trump and the situation with the their intelligence services sharing our intelligence services photographs, I'm not entirely sure that they are the most trustworthy people to be getting involved with at the moment. One of the biggest threats, well, many of the biggest threats across the world are through conventional and through guerrilla tactics, and not necessarily nuclear threats. We must remember that the vast majority of countries on the planet do not have nuclear capabilities. You know, 190 odd countries do not have that. And United Nations are working together, the General Assembly, to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons. All those countries getting together, the only ones who aren't getting involved are the ones that have the nuclear capability. So I do think it's something which is a global situation, and they need to come to some sort of agreement. And the global community do not want these nuclear weapons.
Bob.
Thank you very much indeed. There's a few points raised there, so I'll just try to go through them. I have been until quite recently on regular service as a reservist. I was taken out of the reserve, and for the last 9 years I've either been mobilised or on something called full-time reserve service, so I've done a regular job in the military, which clearly I quit as soon as I got selected here. Just on cooperation, there is an issue with cooperation. My recent boss, my last boss in the military, his next job this summer is off in Paris as a liaison officer with the Frenchies. It is really difficult to work with the Europeans, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do. Everybody wants to. Every government since the 1970s has wanted to deepen European cooperation with the French. But there are significant, and with the other people, and with the Germans, Italians, etc., there are significant problems of doing that on a bilateral basis. Just on practical stuff, the language, the procurement issues, the shared history of working together with the Americans. You know, the fact is that the French aren't always the easiest of allies. And it's been really difficult, despite the desire in Britain to get more out of defence by cooperating with bilateral. It doesn't always happen in practice, Nick. So I agree with your sentiment, but as someone who's seen this at the sharp end, we fall into partnership with the Americans incredibly easily. Now, maybe that's a good thing or a bad thing. That's a different, the politics of that is different, but it is difficult sometimes to get those alliances on a practical level. That's why NATO is a good thing, because it's a system that's it's a system that's imperfect, but it's a system that we know. Now, when it comes to nuclear weapons, yeah, we need that, because look, I mean, the Russians have turned quite nasty. It's an authoritarian, perhaps even in some kind of neo-fascist regime. I'm writing a PhD on Russian warfare at the moment. What they're doing is not nice, and they're attacking us with cyber and information warfare, but also other means to manipulate as well. It's a very sophisticated form of political violence that they're practicing. Vix makes a sensible point here on you know, most of the world doesn't have nuclear weapons. For the ones that do, we need a nuclear umbrella, because I wouldn't trust Donald Trump to protect us apart from anything else. And I'm not a huge fan of his, and he's not a role model for me or anyone else that I know. However, you do make a good point. Most wars that we're in are unconventional. And the problem is that the British military, as a conventional military, trains and practices for high-end, what they call heavy metal warfare, fighting armies with men and women in uniform with big kits, so airplanes, tanks and all this stuff. Actually, most of the wars we fight are unconventional. Syria is an unconventional war. The war against ISIS is an incredibly unconventional war. The war against the Jaish al-Mahdi that I served in back in Basra is an incredibly unconventional war. So actually, we have to get better at doing full-spectrum kind of warfare, going from the nuclear threat at one end to effectively aggressive peacekeeping and anti-insurgency operations at the other.
Okay, thank you. Julian.
Traditionally, on the left of the Labour Party, there's a hostility to both NATO and the Americans and nuclear weapons. And in most regards, I'd consider myself to be on the left of the Labour Party, but actually, this is where I rather depart with my colleagues, because as a historian, I have no doubt whatsoever that NATO was, which was of course a British invention largely, and a Labour invention indeed, was absolutely instrumental in keeping Europe safe during the Cold War era. Now, there is obviously a question about whether NATO is still fit for purpose after the Cold War era, although, as Bob says, with Russia, frankly, going a little bit rogue, then one starts to see the relevance again. But I also think it comes back to this issue of intervention. We've had interventions that have worked. If you look at the Balkans, that was messy when it went on, but the end result has been a stabilised region and countries which are, you know, they're not out of the woods, particularly Kosovo, but Croatia is better, Serbia is no longer a rogue state, Bosnia is recovering. And that was, I think this is an important contrast, that was a NATO intervention. It wasn't a United Nations intervention. I have much less faith as a historian in United Nations interventions, because I just think the United Nations is just, it's too big, it has too many competing interests, and it's one of the reasons why, actually, I don't think the United Nations, like the League of Nations before it, is ever going to be much more than a well-meaning talking shop that we should support, because it represents an ideal of resolving international disputes peacefully. But when it comes to intervention, I have no faith in it. In terms of nuclear weapons, personally, I would get rid of nuclear weapons for probably all the same reasons that Vic wants to get rid of nuclear weapons, but I'm not standing to get rid of nuclear weapons, because the Labour Party's official policy is to retain them. And so as a result, I am standing on that. It's just, for me, it's not a red line issue. I know for some people it is a red line issue, and that will be enough to decide their vote. For me, it's not.
OK, thank you. And finally from Julia.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been a really interesting discussion, and I've learnt a lot, actually, especially from Bob, with your experience. That's very valuable for me, not having that experience. But yes, we have to work together, absolutely. You know, we are stronger together, and it's been proven in the past. And also, we need to be, you know, like unconventional warfare, I think, is so important, like the cybercrime. I mean, look how the NHS, you know, was virtually taken down just a couple of weeks ago through an attack on the net. So we have to be swift. We have to be intelligent, and we have to work together and push past any barriers there are. Like you say, there's difficulty working with our Europeans, so we just have to actually look at the bigger picture and just push past those barriers, which are artificial barriers after all, because we do have common aims. And that's why also I think it's really important that we do continue with our foreign aid as well, to go into countries, educate people, give them water, give them basics of life, so they can then build themselves up, and that gives us a good presence across the world. And just sort of something I wanted to talk about, just going back to the last question, we were talking about Libya and Syria. You know, Colonel Gaddafi was told if they took the blame for the Lockerbie bombing, then he would be welcomed back into the fold, which they did do. And actually, it turned out it was actually Syria that did it. And then what happened to Gaddafi afterwards? You know, it's there's game playing going on, and that we're not all aware of.
Okay, we've got to go to a break now. We will come back, and we're going to talk more about the economy and transport and what we can do with kind of infrastructure-wise as well. But thank you very much so far.
Stay social and get in touch. It's /Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello, welcome back to the Political Soapbox today, talking all about the general election with all of the election candidates for the Isle of Wight today. We've talked already about terrorism and about NATO and our armed forces. So what I'd like to move on to now is the economy. And should the aim of any political party leading our government now to balance the books, should that be what we should be aiming for? Should we kind of post the kind of economic crisis? Should we be looking at how we can balance the books? And if so, when should that be done by? Let's start with Daryl.
Ultimately, yes, because I think it's important that you live within your means. However, you shouldn't put that above absolutely everything else. Because there are things that we do need to spend money on that do cost money, that mean that you can't achieve balancing the books overnight. You know, we've got to remember, and it's something that's come up a lot during this election campaign, that people have been saying, oh, we need to spend money on this, we need to spend money on that. And they've always got a point, because you can spend money on lots of different things. But currently we're borrowing an extra £1 billion a week. An extra £1 billion a week just to stay where we are. Well, you know, as I was talking to someone in Ryde a couple of hours ago in the streets, and he said, you know, my grandchildren are going to be paying that off, or they're not even going to be able to pay that off. So, you know, there is a balance that we've got to achieve of trying to reduce the amount of debt that we've got, trying to stop... What we're actually trying to do is stop borrowing more money, which is that £1 billion a week, but at the same time trying to protect services and not, you know, slashing and burning.
Great.
I think it was David Cameron who tried to simplify economics to this idea of a household budget, that you spend within your means and you spend what's coming in and you don't spend any more. And I'm sure everybody here understands that that's far too simplistic. Governments aren't run on that sort of a basis. You don't get a certain amount of budget that you can do that. You have to go and find more money. Now, you can go and find that money from private enterprise and private business and slash corporation tax, and you try and attract a low taxation economy, which is what Theresa May plans to do when we leave the European Union. Or you can try and spread that, redistribute that wealth and actually gain those jobs. Since 2010, since coalition government, we've lost over 1 million jobs in the public sector. 1 million jobs have been lost. And those people would have been spending that money within their communities. So this idea of let's reduce things, let's keep reducing things, doesn't grow our economy. It's left it to stagnate. You know, this idea that the Conservatives are the people to be relied upon for a strong and stable economic running of the country, it's just been completely thrown out of the window as what's happened to our budget, the balancing of our budget. It's a complete failure to do it through that, through reducing the government spending. What you need to do is actually go out there and find more money.
Okay, Bob, your party manifesto says that by 2025 we should see that budget balance. Yes. Any cost?
Well, again, lots of points raised here. Just on the growth levels, I don't know what statistics the Green Party candidate has, but the ones released by the government show that we've got the highest growth of the G7 nations and have had for the last few years. We have more people in work than ever before, and we've had the lowest unemployment since the 1970s. So we have lost jobs from the public sector, but we've had millions more jobs in the private sector. So those are the real facts as opposed to the politics. I mean, for me, this campaign occasionally sort of comes to resemble a sort of bit of an auction of who can promise the most money to public services. And yes, education and the NHS are under pressure, absolutely, and we have to fight to make sure we have resources on the island. But let's just remember the basic facts. The government in the budget this year is due to spend about £740 billion. Our income, all the taxes it raises, are £680 billion. There is a deficit now of about £70 billion a year that we borrow. Now, that's half what it was under the previous Labour government, but it is still, as a total of our national debt going up, our national debt is about £1.7 trillion. And, Joe, do you know what the sixth biggest item on the national budget is? The sixth biggest item, bigger than transport, bigger than sort of environmental, bigger than a lot of other bits of the budget. There are 11 major items. The sixth biggest is paying the interest, not the capital, but is paying the interest on our national debt. Do you know what sum of money that is? £39 billion a year. The sixth biggest ticket that we have to pay every year is just about £40 billion, just paying the interest on our national debt. That is one third of the education budget. It is slightly smaller than the national than the defence budget. It is bigger than lots of other budget lines. That is a staggering amount of money. And every time we talk about more money here, more money there, we've got to realise that for so much of this, we are borrowing it. So we badly need to make sure that we grow businesses on the island so we can grow our tax base here and businesses nationally as well. Okay, and we're better off doing that under the Conservatives than anyone else.
Okay. I'm reminded of the phrases lies, damned lies and government statistics. I think Bob's statistics may well be right. The question you've got, though, is when you say that the economy is growing by this much, who's it growing for? Because, of course, growth is an aggregate statistic. So if you've got I can give you another statistic. Because to me, as an individual, whether the economy is growing or not only matters if my income's growing. And we are the only economy in the G20 whose real incomes are still lower than they were in 2007. The only one. So it doesn't actually matter how much the economy has grown if every single one of us is actually worse off than we were 10 years ago. Another statistic that Bob gave was employment. Yes, we do have record levels of employment. But of course, if an awful lot of those levels of employment are people on 0 hours contracts, people who can't work full time, people who can't actually earn enough money to get by without having to pay visits to food banks, like for example nurses, then how much is that level of unemployment statistic worth? Because what matters in an economy isn't these aggregate statistics, it isn't random numbers, you know, the national debt and so on and so forth. It's about whether people have got enough money to get by. And at the moment, you know, we are being squeezed. Individuals are being squeezed. I mean, I just want to talk about the national debt briefly. I am an economist by training. And, you know, we are now in the Labour Party. Our manifesto is fundamentally Keynesian. You know, that's where we're going back to. We're going back to Keynesianism. And the idea of that is that when the economy is doing badly, you put money in the economy. That reinflates the economy. More money circulates. That's what the £10 minimum wage is about. That's what banning 0 hours contracts is about. What the Tories did is they applied austerity, they applied savings. And what Keynes called this was the paradox of thrift. And what that meant was, if you actually try and save money in a national economy, because it's not like a household, exactly as Vic said, what actually you end up doing is you end up screwing your economy. So Bob mentioned the national debt. It is at 1.7 trillion. It was at just under 1 trillion when Labour left office in 2010. What that means is that in the last 7 years, the Conservatives and the coalition before them have raised the national debt by more than all previous Labour governments in history added together in 7 years. And they did that by taking money out of the economy with cuts, which meant less circulated, which meant tax receipts went down, which meant you had to pay more benefits for people who are on very low incomes. And where did the money go? It goes to people who fundamentally don't need it. They don't spend it. Rich corporations, rich individuals who stash it offshore in a lot of cases. That is dead money that's not circulating. What Labour's going to do is take it back from those people who aren't spending it and give it to the people who will.
OK, thank you. And Julie, please.
Oh, thank you. So the original question was about balancing the books.
Yeah.
For me, it's actually about balancing how we look at the economy and balancing it for the good of society in general, because I think what we've seen over the last 7 years is this widening gap between the rich and poor. There's no doubt about it. And even in the increase in minimum wage a year ago, it's been swallowed up with increased housing costs, increased food costs, you know, all costs. So it actually means nothing. You're no further ahead whatsoever. And, you know, there's so much we can talk about the economy. It's a massive, massive topic. But just pick up on Labour and the Green Party with their 0 hours contracts and £10 minimum wage. For some industries, especially on the Isle of Wight and the hospitality and the hotel industries, they lose money for 6 months of the year. They couldn't actually exist without having to use 0 hours contracts because they just couldn't. They couldn't employ people. This and actually works for the people that work there as well. I'm not saying it works in everyone, every sort of type of business, but you have to look at the businesses bit by bit. And I think also with the £10 minimum wage, you know, I was out on the East Cows this week helping them raise awareness because they're really struggling because of the floating bridge. One shopkeeper is owing £2 an hour. She's closing on a Monday now because she has to just go to the bank, but you know, it's a day's trading she's lost, but she can't afford to employ anybody even on the minimum hours minimum wage as it is at the moment. And it's all the red tape that goes with it. You know, you've got to have pensions now as well, and for a small business it's probably gone from 16% of your turnover, this is just indicative costs, to 25% of your turnover on wages now. And I was speaking to my friend who's an electrician. Now he's so busy. I said, well, yeah, get an apprentice, you know, get someone to work for you. So I can't. I haven't got the capacity to do all of that red tape, all of that work. And we have to start looking at the circular economy. We have to move money around and think about where our money's going. You know, hey, we've got Asda. The Conservatives forced Asda on us, you know, selling off our employment land to bring Asda. You know, I will be forceful about this. Because, no, it wasn't, Bob. It wasn't, Bob. It was the Conservatives. So I was told that unless I could be vice chairman of the planning committee, if I voted for Asda, and I would not do that.
Okay, Nick.
Because the money goes to America. The profit goes to America. You have to understand that. The profit, if you spend locally, the money stays on the island and circulates.
Well, you know, actually, to be fair, a lot of stuff that Julie said about local businesses and about those things are really important to take into account. And this is one of the problems with Labour's and Green's model of using Keynesian models that failed 10 years ago. Overspend. It's overspend and overspend. And groups become and services become inefficient. You need efficiency. You need to be able to have competition to have efficiency. But you do need to support services that are important to people. Now, Labour have abandoned the idea of getting rid of the deficit. The Tories have abandoned their targets of getting rid of the deficit because their economic plan has failed. under the coalition, the Liberal Democrats, alongside the Conservatives, tried to build a programme that was going to end the deficit by 2017. And then when we left office, the Tories abandoned it and went for their cut, slash and burn budget, which is absolutely correct. Now, the Liberal Democrats, we're not going to do that. We're going to do the mission that we set out to do in 2010, which is rebuild the country from Labour's failure before by ending the deficit by 2020. And this means restructuring the economy so that you spend money on your economy, but everyone pays their fair way into it so that everyone can support that economy. They do it in Scandinavian countries very well. We can do it in this country. And that's what the Liberal Democrat message is. It's a social democrat message with liberal tendencies. Let's free up businesses, but let's have that strong social support behind it so that we can have doctors when we need help, and teachers when we need students to be taught.
Right. What I want to do, just in the with very short of time now, and just to finish off, obviously, if you get elected as MP, every vote should have to go through a for or against door. So very quickly on some key issues, I'd just like to say, if you can answer just for or against, it's very, very tricky, but that's all you've got. You can abstain if you wish to abstain, but for or against on key issues. I apologise, but let's start. If we whiz through very quickly. So, Vix, the first issue is fox hunting, for or against?
Against.
Bob?
I'll vote to amend. So reluctantly for.
Julian?
Against.
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 And Nick.
Daryl.
I'm actually with Bob on this one. I would amend the bill that I think is being proposed.
Okay. Having HS2. More money. Sorry, Bob. More money spent on HS2.
Oh, God, against.
Julian?
Totally against.
Yeah, party's for, I'm against.
Yeah, same with me. Same with me.
And Julie?
Against.
Nick?
I'm actually for it.
Daryl?
UKIP would abolish HS2.
My party's against and I'm against.
Can I just say on this? I mean, it's shocking that the average speed of a Portsmouth Express train to the Isle of Wight is 44 miles an hour. It is slow, but slower than it was in the 1920s. Okay. We need that money spent on getting people to the Isle of Wight.
Right.
Yes.
And the Isle of Line.
Increasing. I know we've mentioned this already, but increasing the minimum wage, Julian.
Yes, to £10.
Julian?
You have to differentiate between the small businesses and large businesses.
For or against, people? For or against?
For raising minimum wage.
Against.
For.
And Bob?
Well, we already have done, so I'm voting for because we have done, but we have to be careful of the effect on small businesses.
Stand up for small businesses. They're beating heart of this nation. You cannot
agree,
ignore okay. small
totally,
businesses.
Totally right.
60% of Islanders work in a small business.
Julie, agreed.
For the renewal of Trident, for or against?
At the moment, for.
Nick, not a like for like, but for nuclear
terror. For.
Against.
For.
And Julian.
Against, but my party is for.
And an Isla local issue, but FixLink.
I want the study, definitely.
Is that the question?
Oh,
is
sorry.
Question
for or against? No,
off the fence, Julie.
Having,
off the fence.
Actually having
for
the FixLink put in place. Post, you know, yes or no to having a bridge
or a tunnel.
In the
current situation, the current knowledge that we have.
Yeah. Okay. Nick.
Against, but I welcome that group to challenge me.
Right.
Local referendum. It's got to be.
Yeah, true. Yeah, referendum.
Totally against, I'm afraid. Terrible idea for the Isle of Wight.
Julian?
I'm personally for, but I think he has to go to a referendum.
Okay, in our last 2 minutes, this is a big challenge. I know it is for all of you, but just
a group hug. Is it a group
one
hug,
word for one main reason why they should vote for you. Okay, if we just whiz through quickly in this. So, Julie, one word.
Independent.
For the island.
That's not one word.
That's one line, independent for the island. Yeah. Thank you.
A change.
Hope.
Delivery.
And Julian.
A better Britain.
Oh, yay! Yay!
That's three words.
That's
three words, yeah.
Okay.
On your
thank
boy.
You all very much for coming on the show and for coming on the show throughout this whole process. We will be there live at the count next week. We're going to have the pundits in talking all about going through the manifestos and what they predict. Well, that's top secret. Okay? You'll find out next week. You can leave
the pundits.
But thank you. Do go out and find. There's loads of Hustings things. Even some other radio station apparently did one this week as well. But do go and have a listen. Thank you all very much. We'll have
thank
a quick
you,
photo.
Bye.
Thank you.
www.vectisradio.com.